From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today is June 19th, also known as Freedom Day, the Black 4th of July, or Juneteenth. It commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. In 1865, Union soldiers arrived in Galveston, Texas, and announced the end of the American Civil War and the freedom of slaves. This was 2.5 years after President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Lillian Grant Baptiste is an historian and storyteller and joins me from Savannah to talk about the history of Juneteenth and why we should celebrate it. Lillian, welcome.
Welcome. Good to be here.
Happy Juneteenth.
Thank you so much.
Now, we visited the Atlanta Juneteenth Festival this past weekend, and our producer, Summer Evans, asked some of the people there this question.
And what is Juneteenth?
I'm not sure.
And what does it celebrate?
I don't know.
It's unity. I feel like it's one love, one world, one peace, one joy, one sound, one foundation.
I was just talking to two people recently. One is a good friend of mine. He really didn't even know what Juneteenth was. I had to educate him on what Juneteenth was. Yes.
What did he say after you told him?
He was delighted. He said he was going to look into it. You got to remember, a lot of people don't know about it.
Well, Lillian, why do you think so many people don't know about the history of Juneteenth?
I think a lot of people, they know about July 4th, but Juneteenth is actually our de facto Independence Day, and they don't learn about it in school. It's not often talked about, although people are becoming more aware of it lately. But it's unfortunate that people are not aware and don't realize the significance of Juneteenth.
Well, tell us a little bit about that history. Why did a group of slaves in Galveston, Texas, not know that they'd been freed until 2 years and change after?
30 months later, after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, it's amazing. There are a few theories. One was that the slave owners deliberately suppressed that message getting to the slaves. Another one was that the federal government was slow, and because they wanted to have one more harvest from that particular state. But I believe it was a combination of who would want to release slaves when slave owners were receiving free labor, and it just did not happen 30 months later.
So it wasn't until the Union General Gordon Granger sailed into Galveston Harbor, Galveston Bay,
absolutely,
and told them. So when did it actually become a holiday?
In Georgia, it became a holiday in 2011. 45 states, and it's still not a national holiday, but in 45 states, it's celebrated as a state holiday. More people are becoming aware. You have more celebrations around Juneteenth. People are talking about it a little bit more, and I look forward for that to even grow even more.
Well, so initially, when President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, this was January 1st, people celebrated Jubilee Day.
Absolutely.
After the slaves in Galveston, Texas knew that they were free, did people immediately start celebrating Juneteenth?
They started immediately gathering themselves, but actually, they started celebrating Jubilee. Whenever they heard the message, they started celebrating their freedom. But really, in 1870s, a group of former slaves actually got together, and they purchased land in Houston, which was extremely significant, and so that they can have a celebration. Prior to that, there was no place you could celebrate, but you couldn't, you know, where could you go to celebrate? I did not have a tremendous amount of land, but to me, this was such an illustration of self-determination and unity. $800 to purchase a plot of land.
That's the land that became Emancipation Park.
Emancipation Park. I was actually in Houston
there for Juneteenth a few years ago. But then,
and that's amazing in and of itself.
Well, this spread across the country, news of Juneteenth, and people, African American communities started celebrating it. Some, you know, have barbecues. They wade into the water. What does this mean for the community?
I think it's a time of reflection, a time that we remember and that we teach our children not to ever forget where we came from. It's also a time that we recommit ourselves to the uplifting of African Americans, to remember and to, you know, commemorate in terms of uplifting our history and talking about its significance and teaching about the importance of being self-determined, the importance of working together and working together to uplift this particular holiday.
Yeah.
So I think all of that is so very significant.
We've got a clip from the ABC series Black-ish. They led their fourth season with a musical episode about Juneteenth. Now, here's a clip. The main character, Dre, is speaking with his colleagues about the holiday.
It's a confusing thing to celebrate me. Do I get you a card? Do you get me a card?
I don't know, Dre. It seems like a straight-up conflict with Father's Day.
In our community? Okay.
And June is the beginning of wedding season.
In our community. Okay.
I'm only hearing excuses. This is what America always does. We think if we don't acknowledge something awful, it didn't happen.
So that's a clip from Black-ish, the ABC series. Have you seen other depictions of Juneteenth in the media, the national media, network shows like that?
I have. It's ironic, but that's kind of, I mean, we think in terms of celebrating the fourth, Father's Day, we think about weddings, but we don't think about so much the significance of that holiday, which is unfortunate.
Well, Frederick Douglass said, "What to the American slave is your 4th of July?" Do you know people who don't celebrate the 4th of July and instead celebrate Juneteenth?
I do.
Why
I
is
do.
That?
Some folks believe that's hypocritical. We were independent. We were very much slaves. That declared America's independence from Britain, but we slaved. We were very, our ancestors were enslaved. So I know a lot of people who would decide not to celebrate the 4th of July and instead they celebrate Juneteenth.
Yeah, because it doesn't quite ring true to them?
Absolutely. It does not ring true at all.
Well, in recent years, Juneteenth has, you know, unfortunately, in 2014 and 15, 16, fallen right around the times that there have been high profile killings of unarmed black men by American police. And so there have been increasing opportunities for protests on Juneteenth. Do you think it's a protest day?
I think so. It should be. It should be. When we think in terms of a lot of the injustice that we see, and particularly, like you said, a lot of things happen during June. I think that is a great way of celebrating and uplifting that holiday and projecting a sense of self-determination.
You mentioned that there are five states that still do not recognize Juneteenth. They are Hawaii, New Hampshire, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Montana. What is their reason? What did they give for not celebrating Juneteenth?
I think it's just in terms of people not speaking up, people not pushing forward, or at least not speaking and not pressing forward as much as perhaps the other states would. And then a lot of it is just, you know, in terms of the decisions around, you know, economic decisions.
Has there ever been a real concerted push to make a national holiday with all 50 states?
President Obama, tried to pass that law, but of course that didn't happen.
I'm speaking with Lillian Grant-Baptiste. She's an historian and storyteller about the history of Juneteenth. Well, let's hear. This is some tape from the Library of Congress. It's Laura Smalley of Texas. She was born into slavery but did not know that she was free. She was one of those in Galveston, Texas, after the Emancipation Proclamation. Again, from the American Folklife Center of the Library of Congress.
We didn't know where to go. Mm-hmm. Mom and them didn't know where to go. You see, after freedom broke, just like you turn something out, you know, didn't know where to go. They turned us out just like, you know, you turn out cattle, I say.
Didn't know where to go. What was the reality of freedom for slaves after June 19th?
I mean, it was sad. I mean, your situation did not improve. Their situations did not improve. Even those that were allowed, they understood that they were free. They tried to leave. Sometimes they were oftentimes killed. They were forced to stay and work for free. Some of those slaves tried to go north to states that were more friendly. They also tried to reunite with families. It was not an easy time. It was a very, very difficult time, a very sorrowful time.
Right. You had Reconstruction, Jim Crow. And now Juneteenth is an opportunity to remind Americans of the contributions that African Americans have made, not only in their culture, but the country, and reminds African Americans of their ancestry. Here's just a clip of drummers from last weekend's Juneteenth festival here in Atlanta. Well, Lillian, you're a storyteller. Do you tell kids, people, stories about Juneteenth?
Yeah, I do.
What do you tell them? We've got 2 minutes left.
I tell them about the importance of knowing where they came from, the importance of understanding what their ancestors went through, the importance of realizing that they come from a people who have gone through tremendous trials and tribulations. But yet we are people who not just survive, but thrive. To tell them that never forget where they come from and to use their past to push them and launch them toward their future. But to never forget, what we went through, to never forget the sacrifices that we had to make and that you have a debt to pay.
How did you, Lillian, learn about Juneteenth?
I learned my great grandmother, which you would never think, taught me about Juneteenth. And I learned about Juneteenth as a youngster, maybe when I was 10 or 11. Her aunt was actually from Texas or lived in Texas for a while. So she was very much involved in, she was an activist and a historian. So she, you know, we oftentimes talked about Juneteenth and celebrated Juneteenth in our home.
Well, Lillian, thank you for sharing your experience of it. Appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you so much.
Lillian Baptiste, she's an historian and storyteller, and we would love to hear from you. How are you celebrating Juneteenth this year? You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at OST Talk or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. And just ahead, we're going to visit the Oakland Cemetery in Atlanta, but first, revisit some real history in museums. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Virginia Prescott. And it is Juneteenth, the day that the news that the 13th Amendment had passed finally reached the farthest corners of the country. And as we've heard, even though the holiday and its history have been known to some Americans, well, forever, others are still learning about it. Over the past few years, Americans have had new opportunities to engage with the unvarnished truth of the nation's history in a number of new museums. Nicole Moore is manager of education and museum content at the Center for Civil and Human Rights. Nicole, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Amanda Hollowell. She's a community organizer in Savannah. Hello, Amanda.
Hi, good morning.
So I'm wondering, for both of you, did you ever see reflections of yourself at museums when you were growing up?
I grew up in Hawaii, so no.
No.
I grew up in Palm Springs, California, so no.
So how was the African-American experience shown in museums in the past?
In the past, it really depended on where you went. For me, my kind of foray into museums was figuring out how sites talked about slavery and then realizing that we can talk about the houses and we can talk about how beautiful they are and the families, but we never talked about the people responsible. And they were always hidden in the shadows, or they were, you know, just called servants, or just different ways to dance around it. And it never really told the story of the complexity of the institution of slavery, of the people involved, of the different relationships that were there. And I wanted to do something about it because I don't want people going to a site and saying, that's a really beautiful house, but not understanding the craftsman who was enslaved that built that house that still stands.
You've hit on something. I was reading an essay by a woman, African-American woman. She and her husband took a garden tour in the Garden District tour in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And the tour guide talked about the servants, and, you know, they were both scratching their heads and afterwards asked him why he used that term. And he said, well, slaves really upsets people. So you can't say that?
People who use servants instead of saying slaves are enslaved, that's really just at this point a cop out. We know who they were. Call them by their name. If you're not going to use their actual names, then don't sugarcoat it by saying, oh, a servant. That may have been a position that they held, but this was an enslaved human being who had no choice.
Well, this year, the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, commonly known as the Lynching Museum, opened in Alabama last fall. The Civil Rights Museum in Mississippi, National Museum of African American History Museum in D.C., and for the Center for Civil and Human Rights, 2014. Why now, Nicole, do you think so many of these museums are opening?
Because it's time. We've been dancing as a country. We've been dancing around this topic for a while, and people are saying, "Oh, well, you know, oh, not now." Well, civil rights, not now. Then we have this. We had Obama, and then they were like, "Oh, post-racial. That's not a reality. We have to actually talk about why these are such monumental moments for us as a country, instead of it just being who we are." And it's because we never want to talk about slavery because for a lot of people, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing for white families who might have owned slaves. It's embarrassing for some African-Americans who are like, I don't want to talk about that. But that's who we are as a country. And everything that we're going through now can be correlated to the institution of slavery. And until we have those conversations, we're not going to be able to move forward.
Amanda, how about for you? You're a community organizer, so you have, you know, a lot of on-the-ground experience. Are people having these conversations in the communities you work with?
Well, they're trying to. And I think also a lot more organizers and even myself are using it to explain some of the trauma that even African Americans have in this country. So when you have a museum or an exhibition, I also sit on the Black Heritage Festival in Savannah's planning committee, and this is what we've done for 30 years. We use this as a way to explain the current state of why you see such angst and despair from a community. And this is the only way you can actually make it concrete for folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, earlier this year, the announcement that Washington, D.C. police are going to be required to take a course on critical race theory and visit the National Museum of African American History and Culture was announced. So what do you think, Amanda, that does for the understanding of, you know, it's not just racial sensitivity, it's looking at a full picture.
Right. So you have to understand the community that you're working with and the trauma that's in that community and meet them where they are. And I think that's some of the biggest challenges we have with our policing system, our justice system. I'm really getting tired of the sentence that I hear from folks who say, oh, get over it. How do you get over this?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, there's, you know, when the lynching museum opened, people were like, well, this is in the past. Why dredge up this painful part of history? What's your, you know, Nicole is shaking her head here. What do you say to that?
So my answer is look at the separation of children at the border and then go back and look at slave cartoons. And you will see that America has does a great job at repeating some repulsive behavior. So this is important. You can't get over it because we're still participating in this pattern of behavior, just in a different form.
That's Amanda Hollowell. She's a community organizer in Savannah. Nicole Moore is also with me. She's manager of education and museum content. That's at the Center for Civil and Human Rights. Well, Nicole, so what are some of the ways that your organization puts together exhibits that make people feel, make people experience history?
Well, the one thing that we're noted for is the lunch counter exhibit, and that's where it is a simulation of a sit-in protest. And usually when people come through the museum, when they come through the center, they're looking at the exhibits. They're like, oh, okay, you know, this is some reading. I hear about Jim Crow and I see the laws. But then once they sit on the lunch counter, it creates this strong empathetic moment where it's no longer just, oh, I'm reading about this information. I've now interacted and absorbed what happened. And it transforms their experience from just reading about it and being passive to questioning, would this have been me? Could this have happened to me? And what would I have done? And it's once they come off of that lunch counter and they have that moment of empathy, their transitions through the rest of the exhibit changes from just this passive, oh, this is nice to read, to very thought-provoking, how would I have reacted? And it becomes very action-oriented for them. And you see people kind of talking their way through the rest of it. They'll see March on Washington and they're like, yay, this is great. But immediately when we talk about the bombing in Birmingham or Mississippi burning, people are driven back to, could I have gone down to the Deep South to do these things? Or how would I have reacted? And that's the draw. And that's what we want them to get, to think about it and then to take positive action to prevent these things from happening again.
Okay, we've got a little clip here. This is from the Daily Share. You're going to hear visitors recounting their experience at the center's lunch counter.
It was terrifying.
It's just hard to imagine that we could treat another individual that way.
I see you crying.
It was very powerful. I think it was really well done, and you could really feel the very difficult things that people were willing to endure.
Amanda, have you been to sit in at the lunch counter at the center?
I've actually been twice. I was just there recently, about a week ago, with a group called 9to5, Georgia's Women Working for Social Justice. And we are a collective of women. So what was interesting was, in my naivete, just about like other cultures' feelings and other people's of color's feelings, we had a large sect of Spanish-speaking Latinx women. And they participated in the lunch counter. And my immediate response was, they're not going to get it, or they're not going to feel the empathy. And when they did the experience, to watch them have a visceral and emotional reaction to it, it actually made me connect with them more, in the sense of, you know, this has probably happened to them recently. Mm-hmm. They've probably had people yell at them and scream at them and say, get out their country and mm-hmm. get out of our country and et cetera. And then when one of the women, I went to console her, and, you know, it was just, she just held my hand, and then watching her reaction, I was like, okay, so even more so, I need to make sure that we're connecting our trauma with each other so we understand how we're all connected in this movement, because we can run through this in silos. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges right now in community organizing. So many people have their one issue that they want to stand by, but they don't understand the interconnectivity of each of all the issues amongst all of us.
So that is a deeply felt experience. It's so different from learning in a history class or reading in a book. But this is the question. I mean, people who want to know the truth will go to those museums. Mm-hmm. People who are clinging to old myths about, you know, what America is will not. Mm-hmm. So are museums helping to create genuine dialogue about the history of Black Americans? I mean, if you're not reaching those populations.
We are. As a community, as the museum field, we are doing more purposeful work. It's not just about diversity and inclusion anymore. It's about really telling the narratives that people weren't hearing before. That's the inclusive piece. It's no longer just saying, oh, we're going to do this or that. It's, we're going to tell these particular stories. We're going to give history a holistic view versus the lens that we've always seen. Take, for instance, this weekend at Monticello, they just opened the exhibit on Sally Hemings. That's a permanent exhibit. That is a permanent, challenging exhibit that changes mm-hmm. an entire narrative of how this country was founded and the man that wrote the Independence document, how we look at him. And that is their drive to say, we need to look at this from a different angle. here is this woman, here is this child who becomes a woman in this household. Let's talk about her, her family, that legacy, and let's face it head on.
Can you imagine right. that happening at, you know, all these colonial villages and antebellum mansions? I mean, is that on the way that people are confronting the truth?
It really depends on their boards.
Let's see, Amanda, were you going to say something?
I was going to say, well, in Savannah, we have like we're a wedding destination as well. Mm-hmm. And lately there's just been this trend of non-people of color saying, oh, I want to do a plantation wedding. And I'm like, no, you do not want to do a plantation wedding. But do you see how we can like look at history in rose-colored glasses? So yes, like I'm gonna go defer to Nicole. It's the board, and it's actually saying like, can I confront this part of history in an eloquent way that people get it and are offended?
Yeah. Well, and it is a business. I mean, I'm looking at figures. Mandela Research says $48 billion annually in African-American tourism. So there are people out there spending money that could come to these museums. How is attendance? Do you know any figures on those, Nicole? Like, how's it doing? I remember when the National Museum opened in Washington, there were lines out the door for weeks.
I mean, I think it's on an uprise, especially now in today's climate. People are yearning to learn more about a different side of history. And so you have more people coming into institutions like the Center or the Smithsonian, and they are trying to find out those other pieces. And we are the source for that. So I think, unfortunately, as this climate continues politically, we're going to see more people coming to these institutions because they're like, wait a minute, what's going on here? And I didn't learn this in school. And it's like, you did a little bit, but here's a chance for you to really dive into it.
That is Nicole Moore. She's manager of education and museum content at the Center for Civil and Human Rights here in Atlanta. Thank you so much for being with us. And Amanda Hollowell, community organizer in Savannah. Thank you, Amanda, for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And now to an Atlanta cemetery where the physical remains of history are being preserved. Oakland Cemetery is in the process of identifying African Americans buried in hundreds of unmarked graves. On Second Thoughts, Sean Powers visited the site and sent this audio postcard.
The African American Burial Ground, Burial Ground at Oakland Cemetery demonstrates racial segregation in America, in life and in death.
My name is Joshua Julius. I am 9. I'm about to turn 10 in July.
It's important to remember all of them because they could have made a difference. It could have been a small difference or a big difference, but they both made up where we are now.
Earn the right to be treated equally with whites, even in death.
So see, that's very good, Joshua. Look at the pictures that are here. See, that young boy may be about your age, and he's drinking from a water fountain. And what does this say?
Colored.
Yeah. So I'm D.L. Henderson, and I'm a volunteer and board member with the Historic Oakland Foundation. Okay, keep looking. Let's see, what do we have here? Can you read that marker? And the kids have a cultural treasure hunt that they're following to find out all about the historic treasures that are here in the cemetery. Okay, now look at the second question. What's the second question?
It says, most African Americans living in Atlanta were enslaved before the Civil War. Find the grave of someone who was born during slavery before 1866.
Right, so before this... Many of the graves, if you look all around you, you won't see marked graves, but there will be people who are buried there. We recently did a study with ground-penetrating radar, right? And they sort of took a camera, basically, rolled it over the ground, and that's what showed up on the film, those where we have those orange markers. Yeah. So that showed probable grave sites. So we may already have most of this. There were 872 probable grave sites listed here that we see with the orange markers. But keep in mind that over 12,000 African Americans have been buried at Oakland since its founding.
My name is Tamia Lewis. I'm here with my daughter, Anaya Lewis.
She's 7.
I want her to learn about African-American history, learn where our ancestors come from,
where she's just getting to the age where I feel comfortable introducing her to things and teaching her about, you know, American history, slavery, and things of those nature.
It's pretty sad that people were slaves.
I don't think she can fully grasp it quite yet, but she's slowly learning how serious and how important it is.
You guys want to walk around some more? Or are you ready to go back up? You've been down here a while. You've been down here a couple of hours. So good work. So turn your cultural treasure hunt in back at the table up there, and they'll give you a little keepsake to take with you to remember your day. Thank you for participating in our hunt.
That audio postcard from producer Sean Powers at Oakland Cemetery in Atlanta. Just ahead, Atlanta celebrates Juneteenth. But first, the story of the largest recorded U.S. slave auction, which took place in Savannah. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow, I'll talk with comedian Tig Notaro, who is performing this week in Atlanta. Ironically, Tig's big break came from a stand-up routine about being diagnosed with cancer. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you turned to comedy to get through a really difficult time? Tell us. You can leave a voicemail at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter or Facebook. Today, June 19th, is Juneteenth. The awkwardness of the word mirrors the holiday's history. President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing enslaved people in 1863. But it wasn't until 2 years later, on June 19th of 1865, that slaves in Texas finally got the news. There are countless heartbreaking stories of the brutality of slavery in American history, including the largest recorded U.S. slave auction, which took place in Savannah. 429 men, women, and children were sold over the course of 2 days. It is now remembered as the Weeping Time. It tore families apart and fanned the flames of the Civil War. But the Weeping Time is not widely known. Kwesi DeGraft Hansen wants to change that. He's a landscape architect in Georgia and an historian on a mission to identify descendants of the Weeping Time. He spoke in 2016 with GPB's Celeste Headley.
Help me understand why this huge event happened. What led up to there being so many slaves up for sale at the same time?
Okay, thank you. It's very simple. There's a slaveholder, Pierce Mace Butler. He was an absentee slaveholder who lived in Philadelphia. He had actually inherited two plantations on the Georgia coast from his maternal grandfather. He was a gambler and basically spent the fortune that had been passed down to him. And so in 1859, he found himself in dire straits and needed to sell something, either his land or his enslaved people.
And he owned 429 slaves?
Actually, he owned 919.
Holy cow.
And, he and his sister-in-law actually owned the two plantations and the people. So he basically elected to have half of them, which is technically maybe what he felt was his, sold. And so that's how come he had 429 sold. To redeem and recoup his losses, basically.
How did they advertise an auction like this in those times? And were they trying to bring in just people that were local, or did people come from all points, far and near, in order to attend?
All right. They actually advertised it far and near. The point of advertisement began in Savannah. There was a very well-known broker, slave broker, that is, in Savannah by the name of Joseph Bryan. So Brian was contacted by the Butler organization, if I can say that, to advertise this. So on February 8th, 1859, Butler had this advertisement published not only in Savannah, but in Charleston, in Mobile, throughout the entire South, basically, all the way from Virginia to Louisiana and beyond.
Did you find copies of that advertisement?
Yes. There are copies. I found copies actually in the Savannah Republican newspaper. There's also a newspaper in Savannah still running called the Savannah Daily Morning News. So in 1859, they published this, and this was publicized and published from February 8th until March 3rd, daily, except on Sundays. And again, so the coverage was wide. And to finish answering your question, when the slave sale actually happened, people came from all over the entire southeastern region as we know it today.
Do we have any idea how many people, unenslaved people, attended?
The only evidence we have is that those who came to purchase slaves, there were about 200 active buyers at the site. Now, that does not include people who are maybe just standing by and watching, but we have an account written by a newspaper reporter from New York. He actually snuck into the South, pretended to be buying slaves just so that he could document this. It's a fascinating, fascinating piece. So he actually records that there were about 200 buyers who were at the auction on March 2nd and March 3rd of 1859.
Now, your focus has been on trying to track down some of these descendants. But before we get there, how much money did this gambler take in as the results of this sale?
It was $303,850 at that time.
That's a huge amount of money for 1859.
That's millions of dollars by today's account. In 2004, someone estimated that the $303,850 was well over $6 million.
Okay, so now you're focusing on tracking down the descendants of the sale. Why? What are you trying to accomplish by finding these descendants?
Thank you, Celeste. I think it is actually a very important thing to try and connect the descendants. You know, this is a tragedy. Oh, sorry, a tragedy by any means.
A tragic travesty. Yeah.
Tragic travesty. Thank you. And I found it very, very alarming, personally, that a slave sale of this magnitude happens and it sort of just goes away. We don't want to talk about it. There were no memorials. There are no markers. Now, especially since 2008, Savannah has had a Georgia Historical Society marker placed there. But even so, it is really still very difficult for people to find the information. So I think for the descendants, they need to know.
Kwesi, you're a landscape architect.
Yes.
How did you end up? And you weren't, you know, this isn't necessarily your history because you were born in Ghana, as you said. So how did you end up devoting this much time to these two days in American history?
All right. Well, I am a landscape architect, and this is landscape history. So that's how I sort of segue into it.
What do you mean it's landscape history?
Well, slavery occurred on the land for the most part. And I was interested in landscapes, and I got interested in a building material actually called tabby, T-A-B-B-Y. It's mostly on the U.S. coastal areas, oyster shells used in construction. But on a trip to research that, I inadvertently stumbled onto a former plantation called Butler Island Plantation. Doing research about it, trying to find more about the tabby, I came across a list of enslaved people who were on the Butler plantations. And I saw my daughter's name, which is a Ghanaian name, Abba. I saw my son's name, my brother's name, my own name. So I was hooked because I realized.
It would take me back to that moment because that has got to be chilling. I mean, you've been in the U.S. for a very long time, but that's a history that I imagine must have felt removed from you to some extent. And then to feel that personal a connection.
Yes, so that's how come, and it's sort of it's a long answer to your question, but that's how come a landscape architect then becomes very interested in the slavery, because I realized a personal connection.
Okay, so you then, if it was not your intent to track down the descendants originally, what was your intent?
My intent was, and I should clarify, it wasn't that I wasn't interested in tracking them down. I was interested in learning more about the enslaved people and the landscapes that they lived on, because I felt that they needed to be commemorated, to be honored. So again, at that time, I was thinking mostly about the ancestral enslaved people who are already dead and buried and gone. But then inevitably, we are linked. So the ancestors we're talking about, or those that I was interested in, are linked to us today. Just as I found names that are current in Ghana today, I realized that the descendants of those people who were sold at the Butler slave sale, or those who lived on those plantations, they're right here.
How many descendants have you found?
Well, let's say that I know a family in California. I have not met this woman. Her name is Annette Holmes, but she is from the Oakland, San Francisco area. And she's a direct descendant of two people who were sold in Savannah on March 2nd, 1859, at that specific slave sale. Now, she has a huge family with her in California. There's some in Texas. In fact, we've been trying to see if we could get about 50 of them to come over here. So that's just one person. I have also met a woman who is in Philadelphia who suspects that her family is from the Butler plantations. That's because her name is Butler, and her father is an aged man. I've talked to him. He's about in the 80s. He's not very, very clear, but he said that they're from Macon, Georgia, and they migrated up there. Macon and Savannah are just, you know, hours away.
Yeah, so, hop, skip, and a jump.
Yeah, when you begin to look at proximities and you begin to look at possibilities, you realize that it's very likely that this is what happened.
Historian Kwesi DeGraft-Hansen speaking in 2016 with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley. They were talking about the Weeping Time, the largest recorded slave auction in U.S. history, which happened in Savannah 159 years ago. Today is Juneteenth, a commemoration of the day that word of the Emancipation Proclamation reached the entire U.S. population. That was more than 2 years after slavery was abolished. Juneteenth was celebrated last weekend in Atlanta's Moseley Park. On Second Thought, producer Summer Evans was there and sent this audio postcard.
My name is Arielle Felix, and we are at the 7th Annual Juneteenth Atlanta Festival. Juneteenth celebrates the last year that the last slaves were freed in 1863, June 19th, in Texas. So we celebrate Juneteenth as our form of Independence Day versus 4th of July, because during the 4th of July, we weren't actually all free during that time frame. So as a Juneteenth festival, we collectively come together in unity and celebrate together.
My name is Sir Classic, down here at the Juneteenth Festival 2018. Today we're at Moseley Park. It's a local park here in Atlanta, city of Atlanta. This particular event has been going on 6 years.
My name is Shirley Barlow. I am a 1973 graduate of Morris Brown College. Yeah. Juneteenth is part of my history because I am an American, not a black American or white American. I'm an American, and we all are American. We're here living together to to make this world a better place. It's all people out here celebrating for the same thing, because if we're not free, the other people can't be free.
My name is Harlem Duru. My company's name is Helm. We do head wraps and hats and fanny packs. I could wrap you right now if you want. This whole place feels like home, which is Africa, where it all started. I feel it. I like the energy here. Everybody's happy and greeting each other, passing out free samples. I like it here. It's nice.
My name is Alexis Thomas. I had a Polish sausage and surprise, but they have a lot of good stuff. I saw like fried fish, and they have like a shrimp Creole. They actually ran out. That's what I wanted, but they ran out. But yeah, and then I had some vegan ice cream.
I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful.
My favorite part is just seeing we as black people coming together in peace, unity, for one common goal.
What we're trying to teach our young people is, no matter when, you're free and you celebrate and let the world know what you're all about. And that's what we're letting them know, that we're free and nothing can hold us back, that we are going to fight to make sure that we enjoy all of the freedom.
Sounds from the Juneteenth Festival in Moseley Park, gathered by On Second Thought's Summer Evans. And that's it for us today, but we always want to hear from you. Last week, we celebrated Father's Day with the hosts of A Seat at the Table, who talked about the myth of the absentee father. And here's what listener Joe had to say in response.
I was calling in response to the absentee black father myth. There is a twisted truth to it. For hundreds of years, during the slavery period, there was a forced selling of black men or black children away from their parents, and separation that happened for hundreds of years. Then you had the Jim Crow, where a lot of black fathers had to leave the household in order to find work to send money back to support the home. Same playbook America has been playing for the longest time, to separate POC parents from their POC children.
Thank you, Joe, for your thoughts. And as always, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. Our show is produced by Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is senior producer. Susan Davis is executive producer. And our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting.